Yesterday we were discussing T.S. Eliot, and so you asked me to remind you of Mark about Mark Bonham Carter.
Oh yes, quite right. He's on this. Now, the story about Mark Bonham Carter, and I was also going to tell you a story about T.S. Eliot and Paris. So those are just two anecdotes. Not part of my autobiography. The story about Bonham Carter is this. It's typical of what situation in England. I didn't think we could put this out. And I'll tell you the story.
You want me to...
Stop it. There's no point. You'll see.
Yeah, I see.
You'll see.
And now about Paris.
The story about Paris is very simple. It shows what trouble I'm in constantly with T.S. Eliot. That's why it haunts me. When Paris came here on his state visit, Mrs. Thatcher gave him dinner in the end. Prince Charles decided to give him lunch. He invited various people, no Jews, and no landlord people like that. And then I received a message from his private secretary, I know him, saying the prince wants to give Mr. Perez a present. He'd like to give him books. We don't know quite what Mr. Perez is interested in. We asked the embassy. So they said poetry, history, in all his interest. Biography, maybe. Well, I racked my head. But history. I couldn't find a single book written in England or America in the last 10 years which was of general interest. They're all monographs. I may be wrong, but I mean nothing like Name Your Trevelyan, nothing that's on, no book of a generally interesting kind. So, I mean, I don't know if you can think of one, I'm sure not. They're all about very specific things. I mean, Norman Stone on the invasion of Russia, or maybe 800 pages, and no point. But books of an interesting kind, collection of essays, nothing that I know of. Well, maybe Trevor Roper, but I don't know. Not for me. But I mean, also about 17th century. I didn't think of it. So with an excess of tact, I chose the biography of Mountbatten. Because he's... the prince, of course, worships him. And Paris would know who he was. And he'd been to Israel. And it has to do with modern history and India, Israel, policy. Yeah, it's readable. And it's... Then poetry came up. So, that's for amuse you. I just read a good book on T.S. Eliot by a man who writes the chief literary editor of the Times, not the supplement, but the Times itself, whose name is, he writes a leading article always, or often. I've got to know him. He seems to be a very respectable critic. Writes novels also. This is his name. Doesn't matter anyway. So I recommended it. It was handed by the prince to Paris, very well received. A week later, the Jewish Chronicle printed a piece saying it's very tactless for Prince Wales to give a book by a notorious antecedent. Really, he should have done better. He must be very bad advice. They knew nothing about me. They do it now, either. So, that was all right, the Jewish Chronicle. Well, the Prince of Wales doesn't read the Jewish Chronicle. What other people would think, it doesn't matter. Then the Times reprinted it in his diary as a sort of tidbit. Then I thought, well, poor Prince, you'll be very embarrassed. No idea about this. Sorry to Eliot. And I said, yes, I'm terribly sorry. I've never thought of Eliot. I think it's a good book. I couldn't think, and I totally forgot. Yes, he was intimidated. It's true. I said that, but it's nothing much to do with his life as a man and poet, and I don't think Paris would know it. And if this gets into the Israeli press and embarrasses you, then I will review it, right? But I'm entirely responsible. He said, well, you better wait a little. And he wrote me a letter saying, well, let's leave things as they are, see how they develop. Then nothing develops. And that is it. So I'm always getting you in trouble with Elliot.
Yeah, but I want to go back for a moment to the London Library.
By all means.
I got it confused. I mean, this committee now that dealt with the fellowship and everything, it's the London Library and not the British Library?
Nothing to do with the British Library.
That's the London
nothing.
Library.
Entirely. Okay.
Now,
London Library is a private library.
Yes. That's the one in St. James?
Yeah.
You praised it a lot.
I did.
And so many other friends of mine.
But?
Is it because they lend books?
Yes.
That's the main reason.
Two reasons. First of all, the selection of books is exceptionally good. If you want to know about a subject, you will find very good books on it. It's very well chosen. They can take what they like. They're not obliged to take all these. They choose very carefully. And they choose serious books, they choose novels as well, and it's on the whole contains what one needs. If you're a reviewer and want to know more about the author, you'll find it there.
I mean, but you can find everything in the British.
Oh, yes, yes.
But then you have to sit there.
Then you have to sit there. Here you borrow 15 books if you're a country member, and you keep them for a month.
That's
well, it's a and wonderful
I,
thing.
I mean, even you from Oxford, it was like going to London to take the to borrow the books.
They send them.
Hmm?
They post them.
They post them. Now
it takes a little longer. They post everything.
And you came across certain in the British Library.
On the shelves.
In the London Library.
London.
You just came across.
I was looking for something else in Russia. I was probably looking for I don't know what Pushkin, Turgenev, I don't know what I was looking for. A particular book. In Russian, because I was fascinated by the fact that this Russian library took an exceptionally good selection of Russian books before a certain date, before the Soviet Union, roughly. A little bit after as well, but not so good. The books are not so good either. But still, they bought very well. I needed something, probably. Maybe I needed nothing. Maybe I was just looking at the shelves of Russian books, trying to be liable to do. I suddenly saw four volumes with the word Gerson on them. That was a some sort of German or French, I mean it's a European, Western edition, 19th century edition of his autobiography. It was printed abroad, of course, because it couldn't be printed in Russia.
But it's quite surprising that that would be Russian books on open shelves. After all, they don't have...
All the books are on the open shelves.
Unlimited space.
No. They don't have unlimited space. They've had an annex recently, partly the money given by Michael Astor and partly by Wolfson, who built them up. There is a building. They are investing. But I mean, they don't buy everything. But the Russian books, I mean, how many Russian books have they got? 200. But even that, 300. They're wonderful. As a selection. You've got the best books by best horses.
Did it ever cross your mind what would have happened had you not gone to the library?
Well, although I'm a great believer in would have beens. Don't accept E.H. Carr's view that history is just autostradas. And big roads, little roads always ending in nothing, which is what he believes. All the side roads end in complete cul-de-sacs. No, I don't know what would have happened. No, I think I would have come at him sooner or later. I would have, what I've been reading Turgenev's memoirs of somebody's, sooner or later I would have become interested. You see, I read Belinsky, for example, probably the result of reading it. And that made a deep impression on me also, the Russian critic. Belinsky
was one of the first articles you wrote was on Belinsky, am I right?
First article where?
I mean, in your bibliography, I
there's a talk after the war on the wires, on the radio, for which I was denounced, either in Pravda or Izvestia, on Belinsky.
And this was the first time you...
I wrote no article about Russian things before the war. Before the war. Before the end of 45. As far as I knew. I think that's right. I read Belinsky all through the war in Washington.
Somehow I thought that one of your first articles, I don't know whether it was...
No, it wasn't an article, it was a talk. It was a talk. Printed in the Listener. Certainly after the war. After I came back from Moscow.
So I see what made me confused.
Because I bought an enormous number of books in Moscow. And now rather in Leningrad, not in Moscow. By that time I was thoroughly... you see, my whole change of life is to do with that, as you know. And I gave up philosophy and decided to write about Russian thinkers. That happened to be during the war.
So the end of the war. No. When you came back from America...
No, you know the story. Yes, I tell it. Yes, in the airplane.
Yes, in the airplane.
Going from Canada to England.
Yes.
So I was already deep in sort of Herz and Kumpelinski. Yes. But I think Herz was the first. I mean, I always read Russian books. I read Tolstoy, I read Turgenev. I never read Chekhov very much, curious enough. I read Pushkin, yes. Gogol up to a point. And essays about them. And histories of literature.
Did you see Noel Amen's article in the New York Review of Books? In the last issue, Noel Amen reviewing Corelli Barnett.
No, not yet.
He uses the term in British intelligentsia, maybe in every other text.
Because he's writing a book about it. Let me explain. Yes. Noel Amen is writing a book about what might be called British ideas, climate. Opinion, I mean, particularly about probably of an intelligentsia type, between the wars and after. Maybe after the war, I'm not sure when. His more sophisticated friends are extremely anxious that he shouldn't write it. No. They think he's not fitted to do it. The idea of trying to persuade him not to do it, he would receive with quite natural fury. Because he regards himself as an authority on that subject. He is the heir of Bloomsbury. He was appointed by Keynes for the Fellowship of Kings, partly because he was regarded as a kind of natural continuator of that tradition. I heard him deliver four very amusing lectures in University College on the, as it were, outsiders in the interwar years, pre and inter. The four outsiders were two outsiders and two general topics. The outsiders were Orwell and Evelyn Waugh. And one was about homosexuality as a phenomenon of the English intelligentsia. And the fourth lecture, I can't remember what that... Leavis. That was the third, yes. Leavis and criticism. Leavis loathed them. Regarded him as a typical cheap journalist who ruined the sort of thing, but it was a very fair lecture. Leavis is dead, and he decided he wasn't just going to avenge himself. Perfectly fair, quite decent lecture. The lecture is very well done. It's a splendid lecture, very dramatic, very like an actor, and he knows how to lecture. And it was interesting to listen to. I didn't agree with the things, but that's obviously a topic to which he's dedicated. And he reviews books for the American Review of Books on those sort of things. So that's why intelligentsia. He, of course, believes there is intelligentsia because he's a member of it. No. I do not. Yes, you see, because I'm rather narrow defined. I believe intelligentsia is a Russian word for a Russian phenomenon. And if you want to, I define, I'm afraid I take a rather narrow definition of it. I know what he means. He means intellectuals, artists and intellectuals. That is not what I mean by intelligentsia.
No, but the term intelligentsia was not common in Britain in general anyway.
It began in the 20s. And I would say, so the Oxford Dictionary says, I've looked it up. And the Oxford Dictionary, it's obviously appropriate, it's a joke. It's an ironical term, used by the right, not the left. And of course the intelligentsia will not agree, etc. It's not a body. Nobody in England says, I'm a member of the intelligentsia. It's always used a little bit in inverted commas. And it's usually, even in Alan's case, with a certain irony. Because by now, he's become gone, moved to the right. And you see, and in a sense, just because of the student riots and terrible time he had in University College, and even worse, the vice chancellor, he looks on all this as sort of left-wing nonsense. And that's why even in his mouth, although he still adores Bloomsbury, I think, if you ask him whether Leslie Stephen was a member of the journey, probably say yes. For him, Leslie Stephen, John Stuart Mill would belong, for me not.
But you see, the very fact that you use the term caught my eye, that means that not very often I come across the term intelligentsia.
You don't. You don't. Certainly not.
I know that you define it in a narrow way. All right, but even though you define it in a larger way, it's not very common use.
No. The word intellectual is used. Yes. And even that not too often. But it isn't used because there isn't one,
yeah.
According to me. They don't feel themselves. As a, you see, look, the definition of intelligentsia really comes quite a bit. The word is used for the first time, nobody knows when. The usual view is it's used by a rather forgotten writer called Bobrikin in about 1874. Turgenev is obviously aware of it as a concept, and I think does talk about intelligent or something. Poles think they invented it. Maybe they did. The point is that the man who really wrote about them, about whom I have written, they say, is a man called Anyankov, who was a friend of Turgenev, friend of Belinsky, friend of those people. He wrote a famous essay called The Remarkable Decade. And in The Remarkable Decade, he gives an account people coming to stay in Turgenev's estate and who they were and what they talked about. That is it. I mean, what they call them, that is exactly, they recognize each other. And he says they were an order of knights. They were a brotherhood. Well, they weren't. They were not a political party. And they were not that left-wing. Some more than others. But they saw each other as people dedicated to a certain kind of cause, and they all believed they had certain common beliefs. And the common beliefs were, and some of them moved to the right afterwards, as inevitably happens in such cases, they believed in science, the West, liberal ideas, progress, rationality, empirical tests. They did not believe in tradition, mysticism, conservatism, authority, and the rest of it. That, you see, in France, you could say that the philosophes were in the intelligentsia. They were. Because they held hands. They felt themselves to be members of a movement. In Germany, less so. But in Russia, it is a real thing, which only gets going in the 30s. And finishes in 1900, somewhere in the 20s, when it's suppressed under the Soviet Union. And there is a term called the Soviet intelligentsia, which the regime uses. Not at all the same thing. It just means people who write very professionals. But mind you, even in Russia, it doesn't mean writers and artists. and you meet doctors and agronomists, station masters, anybody who gravitates in that direction. And you could say that about Israel probably. Because it's probably kind of Russian entrance in Israel too.
Not anymore, but it used to be
20 years ago. 30 years ago.
Exactly.
Yes, chemists. But see, let me tell you, give you an example of what I mean. There is a letter by Ivan Aksakov, who was the son of the man who wrote the famous writer, who is himself a Slavophile. He is writing to another Slavophile, Khomyakov, I think. I don't quite know when, somewhere like 1851, 2. He says, you know, if you go to the provinces, all the you find doctors, dentists, I mean, all reading Bilinski. They don't read us. You see? So it's very clear what is meant. Doctors and dentists and agronomists and God knows what, you see?
And the self-consciousness that they belong to a certain...
Yes, yes.
That's the point.
That's exactly in the sense which Dostoevsky was not, Tolstoy was not, Chekhov was not, Mikhailovsky was, Chernyshevsky was. You see?
And Bloomsbury wanted to be.
Who? Bloomsbury didn't. No, they didn't want to be anything. They were just friends who had views, very intelligent views. And religion was a joke. And they were against their views were very intelligent views. But they were all snobbish, which the real intelligentsia was not.
But what did you...
I mean, they were not interested in the fact that a lot of dentists might read them. Whereas in Russia, it was a social movement. Against oppression, against the church, and against the state. Why you don't have, that's my whole thesis, you have to have a black church and the reactionary state. Then you get an intelligence. If you don't, Church of England was not that.
But would it include, I mean, that a member of intelligentsia, that I wanted to ask you, feels that he has to form his opinion on any issue? That he has
yes. Certainly. The man would be interested, I think. Bloomsbury's interest in politics was very limited. Still, they despised West politicians. Sex, of course. Politicians they despised, being shallow people.
Though they had past views and others that were near.
Past views and they no way remember Bloomsbury.
No, but...
No one, yeah. Leonard Woolf was a professional socialist. And he did know these people. Was a friend. But that was a side, Keynes' economics was again a side affair, or he'd work in the Treasury. That had nothing to do with them. When they met in the evenings in Bloomsbury, that is not what they talked about. No, Lady Pasfield was in no way, nor was Cripps, her cousin. None of those people.
Now, the Straits, for example.
Yes. Yes.
So,
but only John.
Only John.
His father was editor of the Spectator, but was not a politician. Only John. The other Strachey's are all interesting. Freud was a subject. Because James Strachey translated them. Of course. You see.
All right. Now.
But by now, for now, Lennon, those three is exactly the heart.
I know him. I met him several times. I think
that
it went that far.
Well, because it's his subject. Because what does he know about? Only that. One of the reasons why he was unpopular when he was provost, University College, was the professors thought he had no subject, which was correct. And he encouraged things like sociology and anthropology and thought the classics or Latin or Italian studies were very unimportant. And that offended him. British Academy thought it was terrible to elect classical scholars where it could have some modern subject, something new. There's always a little bit fashionable. Certainly. Yes, he was fundamentally no scholar, you see.
Now, who picked it up to write the introduction to personal
Mr. Henry Hardy. I had no idea he was doing it. I was appalled. Appalled. I didn't want anybody to do it. I said, this book doesn't need introduction. Doesn't need it. Because it's just a collection of obituaries. There's no common theme. The other books have some, but this book can't be just a collection of memoirs. But without telling me, because he thought it would sell, I suppose, he asked Noel and then revealed it. And then I didn't do anything. And then Noel Anderson sent me his introduction. I thought it terrible, absolutely dreadful, the first version. So then I had to get hold of him, and I told him what was wrong, factually, wrong about my opinions. The whole thing was extremely inaccurate, and in part, deeply embarrassing. But the Jewish bits and everything. Then he didn't accept it. He was extremely rebuffed. He didn't like these criticisms. Thought he knew more about me than I thought I did. Then I sent Stuart to talk to him. Stuart does know more about me than Noel does. So Stuart persuaded him that he got a lot of things wrong. Just plain wrong. So then very reluctantly, and with extreme displeasure, he did alter it a bit. Not enough. Then I suddenly heard Bob Silvers that was going to be published in the New York Review of Books. That, gave me absolute nightmares. The last thing I wanted was a piece about me, which it was. Published without any reason. It wasn't a review. Suddenly a kind of semi-eloge. So, I wrote to Noel and said, look, I may be pathological about this, but I hate personal publicity. As an introduction, all right. Even there, as you know, there are things which I find simply impossible to face, which I think quite wrong, and highly embarrassing, and certainly mistaken. Still, you've written it your view, your business. I would not have, well, I didn't ask for any introduction, and I didn't want to choose anybody, but all right. But to have it published and read by hundreds of thousands of people, a thing which would really completely drive me mad. Please don't do it. Bob, of course, said, if you don't want it, I won't do it. I didn't tell Noel that. Noel wrote a letter to Bob saying, Bob then wrote to Noel saying, I get Isaiah. He wrote a furious letter saying, I expect a love and a proper outlet for my ideas. I do not wish to be suppressed in this way. I don't even thought, surely it did. But in the end, of course, he didn't appear. And then he wrote to me and said, I will think over what you've said. Didn't say he wouldn't send it to Bob. Didn't say he wouldn't correct things. And he kept me waiting for 4 months before he said, all right. That I found extremely surprising. Our relations remained very good. But I don't know what did it, I suppose, pride, vanity. The very idea of having to change things. This is a piece he'd taken trouble over, and he wasn't going to be told what to do, even by me. He saw that I had a natural interest in the matter, but still.
So that means that, he never discussed it with you while I...
Never, never.
No.
Not a word. He'd written it long before. I had no idea that he'd written it until he had written it.
So it consists of his ideas of your writing.
Yep.
And then stories.
That's right.
Now the stories are those who he didn't interview you.
No.
Just either he heard it from
yes,
you.
Yes, whatever it was.
Or from other...
I don't know what the sources are.
It was puzzling when I...
Understand, no. I had nothing to do with it. At any stage. And it did it.
Well, there is a sentence there that explains what you say. I mean, when you say that...
Well, what do you mean?
There is an ironic sentence there. In your short introduction to personal impressions, you say how much you appreciate that, the accommodation between... you refer to Noel in a critical way, in a very, very...
Politely critical way.
Politely. I mean, there is one sentence. So I could detect that there was a story.
Something wrong. Something is wrong.
I'll show you the sentence. I don't know
okay.
if I
have. Okay.
All right. Now, yesterday, when you told me about the letters that were stolen, was it just a selection of letters...
I have no idea what was taken. I have no idea what was there.
It was not the type that you kept...
No. I just stuffed letters in the drawer.
So you have no idea what was there?
I have no idea. But all were taken apart. I know nothing. All I saw was four letters to me, or about me, for sale in South of his catalog.
Yes. And one of them was from Berenson.
Certainly, yes.
Did you
correspond with him? Yes, a bit. Not very much. I didn't... my story about Berenson is quite simple. I knew who he was. And I was one day, when I was a young doll, I think about 1934, I was running for a train in Oxford Station. It almost started moving. I got into a third-class compartment. And there was Kenneth Clark, who was then keeper of the Oxford Museum, director, whom I knew. Clark said, well, if we're going to be squeezed, might as well be by friends, not the most welcoming introduction. I got in, sat down. I could have said, I'm so sorry, I'll find another compartment. I was a bit embarrassed. Sat down, and opposite me, little man with a little beard. I suppose I was introduced. I thought he was the most awful little man I'd ever met. I thought, it's quite awful. Snobbish, affected, elaborate, artificial, terrible. I had no idea who he was until afterwards. That was it. I didn't think about him. In 1938 or thereabouts, his step-granddaughter, who was the granddaughter of his wife, who was called Barbara Strachey, married my school friend Halpern, son of Georg Halpern.
Was your friend?
He was my friend, yes.
From St. Paul's?
From St. Paul's, and Oxford. She was a widow, and no, she was then not quite married to him. No, she may have been, I don't know. Anyhow, she was the granddaughter of Berenson's wife. I asked her to dinner with him in London. I refused. Then came the war. And then I went to Italy for my holidays. In 1950, I would say. And I met... No, I remember. First time was 46, 47. A very cold winter. I went with Maurice Barra to Florence. I met somebody I knew. So I don't know, it might have been Friar Stark of all people. He said, oh, you're here. BB, as he was always called. I'm so glad to see you. I know he'd love to see you. Do ring him up. He'd be so happy. So Maurice Barra said, he met me a long time ago, took no notice of me, missed his chance. He will write a letter saying, dear Mr. Berenson, we're only here for 2 weeks. I shall definitely not be able to come and see you. I didn't do that, but I didn't see him. Then 1950, I don't know how it happened, but I received a letter from him saying that he knew that I was in Italy and would be very kind of me if I came and stayed a night or two. In Settignano, which was his companion's house, not his own. So I was with James Joel and a philosopher called David Pears. We went along. I was curious. I was very well deceived. By this time he must have been in his 80s. And we given our rooms. We came down to dinner. And it was very formal. Sometimes there were us three, him, and what's her name, Nicky Mariano, his friend who lived with him. We looked after him, you see. And I think her sister, Bernadette Unrep, who looked after the library at Itati, in the answer to them. Butlers and food. He came out of a little side door and just explained to me afterwards that his watch was always warmed before it was put in his waistcoat in case the cold penetrated to his skin. And we had ordinary dinner. He had some kind of some softened food, you know. And then he began talking. Sometimes he talked alone, sometimes in duets, sometimes quartets, sometimes sextets. Extremely formal, like an opera, and very elaborate. Then, at some point, he asked me where I'd been. I said, I've been in Israel. Ah, Palestine, he said. Palestine. I was there in 1890-something. It's the most beautiful cemetery I've ever seen. What have the Jews done to it? My God, what have the Jews done to it? Too terrible. Well, I defended Israel, as you can imagine. So he went on in this style. Then we managed to get the conversation off Israel. We talked about duchesses and grand ladies, and that went much better. And I knew them, he knew them. Snob talk. Then we went to bed. In the morning, he asked me to come for a walk. I remember very well, we went uphill, he was about 85, and I puffed and panted. He said, can I lend you my stick? It was very typical. He then said, you may be rather surprised by the vehemence with which I attacked the Jews last night. Let me explain the reason. When I was a young man in America and poor, the purse proud German Jews, remember the phrase, purse proud. And yeah, I never heard anyone say that, but there is such a phrase.
I've never, in English or in German?
In English. Oh, absolutely, but I mean, it's sort of rather special. Oh, it exists. The purse proud German Jews were very nasty to me. And the scars of those wounds still linger. You know, I fancy that today I would be eligible to clubs to which these people would not be eligible, even now. Not that I would dream of wanting to join such places, but I think in some way that is the case. But that is the reason for my particular attitude towards the Jews, which you may have noticed. I then said to him, but I thought that Mrs. Otto Kahn was a very great friend of yours. She's certainly of German Jewish origin. I'm told you write to her at quite frequent intervals. Certainly, he said. Heidi Kahn is one of my greatest friends. She's one of the most monstrous beings whom God has ever sent upon this earth. I adore her. I simply love her. She's a dreadful woman. She is one of my greatest friends, and I'm very, very fond of her. That's how he talked. All right. And that was it. Then, when I came to see him again, with Aline, I think, and he said, you know, I must explain to you, I really meant to write a great masterpiece. People said I wasted my time on social things. But I forgot that during the first visit, he did a very good account, perhaps it's not needed for this purpose, about the difference between the snobbery of Proust and the snobbery of Oscar Wilde. Both of whom we knew. And yes, he was. He knew them both. He was certainly very, very extremely shrewd. Very well done. In fact, I said, you know, he lived in the same house as Wilde at one time in London. I said he had a relationship to Wilde. I told Richard Ellman this, who misunderstood it, put a footnote saying, according to Isaiah Berlin, they had a homosexual relation. That's not at all true. Not at all. It's a relationship. But it doesn't mean, I mean, the ordinary meaning. Right. Can't be helped. Now, historically embedded. Anyway, he then said, later on, explained to me that he was, the war interfered. That's why. He then said, you know, I'm quite interested in Yiddish. Because, you know, his first printed work was about Russian Jewish literature, some Harvard periodical, 1870-something. For example, it's very interesting, Kehlenen means to kill. The German is töten. So there is a connection, English and Yiddish. How curious. Or what about pen? The Yiddish word for pen is pen, not Feder, which is the German. It went on like this. You know, I need this for my business, for which he meant his work, or not. There are certain things in Yiddish which have some relationship, something I want to write about. God, you know, mere mention of Yiddish, something he wouldn't have done in the last 70 years of his life. Then I read him, I went to Israel again, and I read him a letter about being in Naples, where I took the ship, and how different it was when we were waiting, sort of waiting to get onto the ship, between the Israelis and the Jews. The Jews were immigrants. They screamed, they shouted, they were disorderly, and so on. They